This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Another week, another collection of revolting videos of sewage being pumped out into one of our rivers, this time the Thames. Another week and another set of stories in the business pages about the financial troubles of the UK's biggest water company. Thames again, as it happens. What's gone wrong with Thames Water? How does it reflect on what's happening to the whole of our water industry? What can we do about it? And who would have to pay? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. To begin with, I want to take a closer look at the crisis-hit Thames Water and find out whether the problems they're experiencing are shared by other companies. Joining me in the briefing room are Kate Baylis, Research Associate in the Department of Economics at SOAS, University of London, and David Hall, Visiting Professor in the Public Services International Research Unit at the University of Greenwich. David Hall, how many water companies are there in the UK?
In the UK altogether, there's about 17. There's two public companies. One is in Northern Ireland, where it's run by the public sector. One is in Scottish Water, where it's run by the public sector. Then there's Welsh Water and a much smaller one in Wales. And then there's nine water and sewage companies in England and four small water-only companies.
Are these divided by geographical area?
The big ones that we're all mainly concerned with, they're based on river basins, so big areas. And they were designed like that. It was very enlightened at the time in the 1970s to provide for integrated river basin management. So the water resources and the sewage pollution was managed together to get a good result.
Kate, what area does Thames Water cover?
Thames is the largest water company and it covers London and the Thames Valley and goes from Cirencester in the west through to Sevenoaks in the east.
Right, OK. And when was it formed?
The private company, Thames Water, that we know now, was formed at privatisation in 1989.
Why was it privatised?
So this was part of a bigger programme of privatisation. We privatised energy and telecoms in a similar time. And it was part of a sort of ideological shift to bring in more private and less government associated with reducing the role of the state, with an idea that the private sector would be more efficient. But also it was coming at a time when there was a need for more investment in the sector with the European Union Water Framework Directive coming in. And the government was keen that the cost of financing investment would not sit on the government books. It could be put with the private sector. So the private sector was intended to bring investment as well.
Right. Now, what went alongside the privatisation of what had been a public company, of course, was the need for regulation. Can you just explain who regulates the water industry?
OK, there are three elements to water industry regulation. There's the Drinking Water Inspectorate, the DWI, which regulates water quality. And then generally they keep a low profile because water quality tends to be very good. So that's them. Then we have the Environment Agency, and the Environment Agency regulates the environment generally, and then water and sewage companies come within that brief. So the environmental impacts of water and sewage come under this. This is just in England. In Wales, the environmental regulator is Natural Resources Wales. And then we have the economic regulator, which is Ofwat. And Ofwat has its main briefs are to protect the interests of consumers, and they also are required to secure that water companies properly carry out their functions and that they can finance the carrying out of their functions.
David, in all that, what's the role of government?
The role of government is really quite distant and hands-off. On the water side, the regulator is very specifically described as independent, and the House of Lords, who know a thing or two about this, described it as that means it's not accountable to any government minister or an elected body. It has the power to make ministerial-type decisions, but without any direct political accountability. The Environment Agency is different. The Environment Agency is sponsored by the Department of Environment. And so we have seen with the Environment Agency, for example, government directly intervening to actually cut the resources they have because they felt they were interfering a bit too much with business decisions.
OK, let's talk now about Thames Water specifically. Who bought it initially and who owns it now?
What happened initially with the water companies, as with many of the other privatised companies, energy included, the government had a golden share, which I think lasted for about 5 years.
And that's where you have a significant share in something enough to affect its decision making.
Yeah, it had huge power over just one decision, who could buy the company. So the government didn't want to use it for anything else, and I don't think they ever did. But the end of 5 years had expired, and anyway, the EU had decided that was uncompetitive. So it then simply floated free on the stock market, and it was first bought off the stock market by big German energy conglomerate RWE, which also moved into energy operations here. RWE then sold it on to Macquarie, and Macquarie has since sold it on, and it's now owned 30% by, believe it or not, the Ontario Municipal Employees Pension Fund. So the municipal workers of Ontario, Canada, are the primary owners of Thames Water. Second one, owning 20%, is the University Teachers Superannuation Fund here. And there's then a bunch of smaller investors, including from Abu Dhabi, from China.
Kate, David mentioned, amongst all those companies, Macquarie. Now, they play quite a big role in this, don't they?
Yes, so RWE had the company from 2001 until 2007. So in 2007, they sold it to a consortium that was led by Macquarie, the Australian Investment Bank. They changed the financing structure quite substantially. One of the things they did was increase the debt substantially. So when they took over in 2007, debt was about $3.2 billion, and by the time they left it, it increased to about $10.7 billion. So a big chunk of the current debt levels that we're seeing at Thames, they stem from this period when Macquarie was in control.
David, why did they increase debt so much?
Good question, because the study done a few years ago worked all this through in terms of starting from the question, how was the capital expenditure financed? And what the study found was that actually all the capital expenditure carried out by the firms, certainly up until 4 or 5 years ago, was carried out using a surplus from consumer payment. In other words, there was no actual need to borrow anything for capital expenditure. It was all covered, and a small amount left over for dividends, all of which might have been fine, except that was not enough for dividends as far as the companies were concerned. And so what all the companies started doing, including Thames, was taking on debt because they were allowed to under the regulations, and that helps them pay much bigger dividends. And so you can see that in the big figures. In real terms, since privatisation, there's been about $77 billion paid out in dividends, huge amount of money. And the debt has gone from zero to about $64 billion. £15 billion is Thames Water's debt.
I don't understand. How can you pay out in dividends when you're just racking up your debt?
Well, if you've got a guaranteed income stream, that's one of the joys of regulation. You make your money not by competing in a market and risking whether you're going to actually be able to make enough profit to cover these dividends. What you're doing, and the companies are doing it right now with Ofwat, is you negotiate with the regulator for the next 5 years what the income stream's going to be. Once you've got that, you can work out pretty confidently what kind of dividends you can get away with, and you can tell the regulator you're going to borrow to make the investment.
Kate?
A couple of points here. So Macquarie introduced a new financing structure which allowed them to increase debt to higher levels than would normally be allowed. They set up a process called whole business securitisation via a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands, and this was done by some other finance-owned water companies. That's what allowed them to increase their debts to much higher levels, and now they have the highest level of indebtedness in the water sector. But the other point I just wanted to make was about regulation. You would think regulation would step in here, but the regulator, Ofwat, deliberately didn't intervene in capital structures and dividends. These were seen as outcomes of what was considered to be a market, an imperfect market, but nevertheless, the whole framing of the system, the structure, the regulation was market.
David, I don't want to be propagandistic about it, but I just want to establish kind of simple fact here, really, which is essentially that what people perceive as underinvestment in key elements of the water industry, leaks, say, or the sewage problems, have partially happened because the companies have decided to rack up debt and pay large dividends rather than use that money for investment. Is that a fair commentary?
Yeah, I think it is absolutely fair. If you go through the sums over the years, there has been about 190 billion of capital investments since privatisation. There's been 77 billion taken out in dividends. There's been nothing coming in by way of shareholder investment. The amount of shareholder money in the companies today is actually slightly less than it was in 1989. So in all that time, we've got no extra capital from the shareholders. So I think precisely fair and correct to say that the capital investment has been financed out of surplus and the dividends are paid out not to reward shareholders for risking their capital, but simply to reward them for owning the companies.
And can we just get straight? This isn't just Thames Water. This is across the industry as a whole.
Absolutely across the industry as a whole, and including the companies that are still listed on the stock exchange.
Right. So, Kate, let's look at how the companies have actually done in areas where investment was required, say, particularly in stopping sewage going into our rivers and in stopping leaks of significant amounts of water.
One thing I would say on leakage is that leakage is a problem globally. Water's like that. It leaks. It seeps. It's not like anything else that you want to try and control. It evaporates. So it's really difficult to manage. So plugging leaks in pipes is a really difficult thing to get right to 100%. Possibly a better way of considering it is maintaining asset health, because there's always going to be leaks from water.
What does maintaining asset health mean?
40% of the pipes of Thames Water predate the 1920s. That's partly why we're having these problems. This is old infrastructure.
David.
Kate's quite right. It's an endemic problem. It's a systemic problem of water systems. But it can be much better than is done here in the Netherlands, where there's some pretty old towns and old pipes as well. The leakage level is around about 4%. Here in London, it's more like 40% across. The Ofwat avoids these days from giving those percentage leak figures, but the last time they came out, it was around that sort of area for London, and I think about 28%.
But anyway, your point 9%. Is that the Netherlands, which has a similarly aged system,
can do it better. Yeah, considerably better.
Considerably
better. Why? Simply because they've got an investment programme. I mean, in the Netherlands, water privatisation's illegal. All the water services are run by the public sector, and they created in the 1950s a special water bank in order to provide funding for water investments. It's proved so popular, it's now the fifth biggest bank in the Netherlands, and it funds lots of public infrastructure, not just water and sewage. So we need to be more like the Netherlands and think more like the Netherlands. But if I can come back to sewage treatment plants, we now know as a result of some compelling bits of research over the last couple of years that the sewage spills we're seeing in the rivers are not simply a result of climate change bringing us worse weather. They are, to some extent, a result of population change. There's been, like in England, for example, the population has increased by 20%, 10 million nearly, in the 30 years since privatisation. So that's a lot of extra sewage going into the system. But what should have been happening is the companies investing to expand the capacity of the sewage treatment plants to deal with the extra sewage. That hasn't been happening, and that's where the spills are happening.
Sorry, David, are you saying that we simply haven't expanded sewage treatment at a rate sufficient to deal with the population that we have?
Yeah, That's absolutely right. There was a study in Oxford a year and a half ago that estimated that Oxford has had a growing population and its population is still growing, and it is officially expected that in 10 years' time, 8 years' time now, the main sewage treatment plant for Oxford will only be able to manage 60, 64% of what is coming into it.
And we know this now?
We know this now.
And have the things been done which have set in train the expanded capacity or not?
No, the problem that you get is that what are supposed to be incentives in the system simply don't work, or actually work in the opposite direction. The incentive in the private system is supposed to be, if you invest the money in the services we want, then we'll let you increase prices and take a fair profit and everybody's happy. But the way the system works, and we're seeing it working now, every 5 years, the companies submit plans, in inverted commas, which if you try reading them, which I don't particularly recommend, it's a lot of aspirational stuff on the basis of which they say, and so, what Thames Water has said, for example, we would like to increase prices by 40% in real terms over the next 5 years. Astonishingly high amount. And so if they're allowed to increase prices that much, it will be on the basis, oh, yeah, well, they've got all these investment plans. But then the next 5 years go by, and at the end of every five-year period, what always happens, it's happened at the end of the one just ending, is companies underspend their capital programmes. Why wouldn't they? Because there's a clear incentive, obviously. You've got the money coming in, but if you underspend your capital programme, you've got a bigger margin.
I mean, I always thought the regulators were there essentially on the side of the customers and the consumers, and they were there because we know what, you know, capitalism red in tooth and claw can do if you don't regulate it. You're painting a slightly different picture of how regulation works in practice.
Regulation's really interesting. Before I was looking at this, I thought it was somebody set the rules and made the companies follow them, and it was all done and in a clear way. But as Dave mentioned, the price-setting process, which is the fundamental cornerstone of the regulatory control, is based on uncertainty, is based on what's going to happen in the next 5 years. So we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen to interest rates. And it's heavily negotiated. I mean, the companies, Ofwat, bring in lots of consultants. So much money is spent on this regulatory process to derive these prices that companies can charge. It's really important for companies just to tweak the anticipated cost of capital, for example. A tiny tweak will hit their bottom line substantially.
So what you're saying is that the industry plays the regulators?
It's quite a kind of closed shop. So we have a revolving door between the regulator and the companies. So it operates in a very narrow world, I suppose, dominated by finance and financial and economic issues. And things like social justice, environmental sustainability, generally don't get the voice at the table that they should do compared to finance and economics.
Kate Bayliss there with David Hall. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about how big a threat China poses to the UK, the one about what's happened to Hamas, and the one about assisted dying. OK, back to the water industry. We've heard about the problems, but are they fixable? And if so, how? I'm joined now by Sudita Helm, Professor of Energy Policy at Oxford University, and Julie Bygraves, Public Policy Analyst and expert on utility finance. Let's start off this section by looking specifically at Thames Water most recently, Dieter Helm. How has it got into the problems it has just recently so quickly?
Thames has been a problem which has been brewing for quite some considerable time. There have been problems about leakage, problems about sewers and so on, which have exploded into the media in the last year. But the reason why it's the standout candidate for trouble, if you like, within the water sector is the combination of the indebtedness it's taken on, which was what the regulator allowed to happen under the previous owners. It's about extremely poor management, and that's compounded by the fact that when things go wrong, the fact that Thames is just too big, I mean, it's largest by far water company in the UK, it's one of the biggest in the whole of Europe, and if the management is just mediocre, it's going to be much more apparent what's happened. And then there's the immediate financial crisis it faces, and in particular, the need to put back equity into the business. And in the current regulatory context, that is, to put it politely, really rather difficult.
Julie, those are problems, some of which are specific to Thames Water in their scale, but are they also generic to the industry as a whole? In other words, I suppose what I'm asking is, how sustainable is the UK water industry?
Yes, I think that this is a problem across the water industry because the funding model actually means that consumers pay multiple costs of the water companies, including the cost of debt. So that drives up the level of debt that Dieter has referred to. So consumers are providing implicit guarantees and covering risks for the companies while the companies are handsomely rewarded.
So essentially the companies are handsomely rewarded for not doing their job.
Yes, and this is leading to risks to the financial viability of several companies, as we've seen in the industry. I mean, companies are making profits on the cost of the debt, but also consumers are paying the operational costs, depreciation for infrastructure costs, and the cost of debt, tax, and other adjustments. So consumers are paying for a lot. And the question is, what risks are the investors, or perhaps better named creditors? What risks are they taking to justify that reward?
Dieter, if the model's no good for the customers and the model's no good really for the companies, actually, because they're actually facing significant problems, who is it good for?
Who it works in favour of depends upon whether it's properly regulated. So this is a perfectly good model to deliver what's required if the regulator does his or her job properly. But if you allow the companies to essentially financial engineer the balance sheet and you do absolutely nothing about it, then you will get the kind of consequences we get today. It's like if you've got a goal and you ask someone whether they would like to fire at it and you first remove the goalie and then you take the referee off the pitch, then you can't be surprised that the ball is fired into the net. And that's exactly what's happened. But to say that as a result, we want some other regulatory model, it behoves anyone advocating that to tell us exactly how that is and exactly how it is that the various components of the costs will get paid, because ultimately nobody invests for the fun of it, whether it be government, whether it be local authorities or privatised companies.
If the regulatory model is okay, but the regulators haven't been doing their job, how do you get them to do their job?
Well, regulators in this country have a considerable amount of discretion. If you go to the heart of the financial engineering that's taken place, what happened was that these companies were privatized with balance sheets, and the balance sheets were supposed to be used to borrow money to invest so that current customers wouldn't pay for that investment, but future customers who got the benefits would. And that's a perfectly okay model. It's like a kind of private sector borrowing requirement. But if someone comes along and says, hey, I tell you what, why don't I go down to the bank and ask them whether I could just mortgage the assets and take the cash out? You might think that any regulator would say, that's not okay. And many of us, including myself at the time, said this was crazy. You should never allow this to happen. But they let it happen on the, in my view, very bad argument. They thought, well, the private sector should be able to do what it likes with its balance sheet. It can take the money out, but if it takes the money out at some future date, it might have to put the money back in. And of course, the obvious point now is the horses have bolted, and telling the new owners of Thames, for example, to put money in that other previous owners took out, it would be laughable if it wasn't so serious.
So it has been a perfectly good regulatory model, but mistakes were made at the beginning of privatisation, which mean that we are now saddled with a situation that we can't get out of, from what you're saying.
Not at all. The mistakes weren't made at privatisation. In fact, the balance sheets were propped up with extra cash to make it easier for them to do the investment required. The mistakes were made about 5 years later when the prices were reviewed. And they were made both by the electricity regulator and the water regulator. And that mistake plagues our sector. But what to do right now? Well, there's an obvious regulatory solution to this problem. We should call in the special administrator, take Thames away from the hands of its current owners and managers, restructure the business to a reasonable size, and pass it on to new and better owners who will have to pay, and therefore they won't pay as much to buy Thames. They'll have to pay to make up the capital maintenance and the investment that Thames itself has not done and should have done. We just rebase it. It's a perfectly proper mechanism. It's set up for this purpose. And right now, politicians and regulators are doing exactly the wrong thing, which is to run away from this option.
Now, Julie Bygraves, at this point, I can hear maybe one or two older listeners, as old as me, thinking, well, actually, why not say that privatisation has failed and that we should renationalise water?
Well, I would look at this question in a slightly tangential way. I think that Parliament really needs to debate what returns are acceptable to investors or creditors, depending on which way you'd like to refer to them. The regulators need to be accountable fundamentally to citizens and to Parliament.
Dieter, what's your view about whether privatisation has crudely failed or succeeded? And should anybody want to, the possibilities of bringing it back into public ownership, the pros and cons?
The basic idea that private companies would deliver the outputs decided upon by the various regulators and indeed ultimately by the government is not a bad one. And the idea that these companies should be regulated under licence by independent regulators and not with day-to-day interference by politicians is not a bad one either, as long as the regulation is carried out correctly. The idea that, well, you know, why don't we just renationalise it? And there are sort of two versions of that. One is the belief that these are all nasty capitalists and we don't want the private sector involved in these things, making dirty things like profits, etc. And that's a perfectly legitimate view, which I just happen to think is wrong. The second view is the idea that the government would be better at running the industry in its roughly its current kind of structures and forms. And I would ask, where's the evidence for that? It's not the case that the government owning these companies doesn't have to borrow money to invest. It's going to grow on trees. It has to pay a return on those investments, just like a return has to be paid on the regulatory asset base. And before people get too carried away about the delights of nationalisation, we also have to bear in mind that Network Rail and the Post Office, as two outstanding examples, are not ones which I think anyone particularly wants to follow.
We should just remind people that Network Rail is actually state-owned at the moment, just in case they think it's part of the privatised rail industry.
Yes. I mean, the reality is the day job. We need to get these companies run efficiently. We need to borrow an enormous amount of money to pay for the investment because current customers don't want to pay for it. And we need to do it in a framework in which regulation both protects the investors, because people aren't going to invest unless they have some protection, and protects customers. And what we've got is an outcome which does neither of those things properly. And that's, in my view, because we've had extremely bad regulation. It hasn't been as bad in other sectors. It's particular to water, and the mistakes that were made can be put right. But right now, it needs a pretty clean slate, and that means bring in the special administrator, take back control of Thames Water, break it up so it's not this huge monolith, and then pass on to new owners who can run it better and are charged with the job of making good what Thames hasn't done, as well as taking the business forward.
Dieter Helm there with Julie Bygraves. My thanks to them and to David Hall and Kate Bayliss. And my conclusion is, if you must go wild swimming, do the butterfly stroke in your local swimming pool. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Graham Puttyfoot and Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Alex Krotowski.
And I'm Kevin Fong.
How do you feel about AI?
Does it scare you?
Very quickly that question comes up. You know, is it going to think for us?
Does it excite you?
I say, how is the AI going to help us to think better?
Do you worry about how it'll change your life, your job, your kids?
AI is built into many of the software applications that we now use in the schools every day.
In every episode of The Artificial Human from BBC Radio 4, Kevin and I are here to help. We will chart a course through the world of AI, and we will answer your questions.
It doesn't just lie, but it lies in an incredibly enthusiastic, convincing way. That ability to be able to kind of think critically is just going to be so important as we move forward.
The Artificial Human with me, Alex Kratosky.
And me, Kevin Fong.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.